welcome to TRK Mailbag. My name is Tom Savage. I'm delighted to have you on this podcast on the 5 euro tier. If you have any questions you'd like to send in to future TRK Mailbags, you can. info@3rkings.com. Put TRK Mailbag in the subject line. I will get to your question eventually. I have my new mic. The new mic is powerful enough that if I put it up to its full setting, I can hear my own heartbeat if I stand too close to it. So it's pretty nifty, this thing. The first new mic I've gotten since 2017, which will give you an idea of the longevity of the previous mic, but also how broken it was, because this sounds like night and day different. Also, it allows me to have little gimmicks like this, where I can go little air horns or like that, which, look, they're annoying, but they're something I might use in future. But yeah, look, you've sent in a ton of questions over the last while. I haven't been able to record because I haven't had my mic. So I have my mic now. I can look at the questions that I have in here, and I'm just going to get to them in order. Some of them are very, very recent. I'll get to those first. And in the aftermath of some of the press reports that have been in the English media in the last day or so, people basically wondering, what is up with English rugby? There have been a few newspaper columns and a few reports of players being unhappy in the English setup as it currently stands, saying that they barely touch balls in sessions and that they're far too focused on their blitz attack than what they maybe should be. And again, look, I understand their reluctance and their reticence, I think, as well. Training defense relentlessly is boring. It is, like, it's boring. At the same time, though, it's unusual to see those kind of complaints being directly assigned to players in camp, because that is not a great sign at this stage for Steve Borthwick. That shows that there's a lack of internal discipline, that players feel comfortable complaining to journalists, either unknowingly or knowingly looking to put this out there to kind of take a bit of pressure off themselves, maybe, to make it seem that, well, we don't agree with this way of playing that we're doing. And I think part of that comes back to as well that England are playing something that can be a little difficult to accept from a style perspective, which is kick pressure with a high edge blitz and a big focus on set piece. It says straight away that one of the main focuses of your team is going to be kicking the ball and box kicking the ball, which England do a fair bit. And that is an unpopular facet of the game at the moment. Like, if you were to ask any fan, like, be they a casual or, you know, fairly hardcore fan, one part of the game that they would get rid of tomorrow, it's the caterpillar ruck. And England, like, they use a lot of those. They remind me a little bit of South Africa in the early days of Razzie Ball, when he was just after moving there. And he just stripped all of their game back. And, like, England were already on that route. I had assumed that the success they had in the World Cup, getting to the semi-final, missing, but, you know, losing out in the final by the kick of a ball, that would have bought Steve Borthwick time. And they've won 2 out of 3 games in this Six Nations. So it's a bit weird to me to see this much pressure and this much criticism coming their way so quickly when, as I said, like, they've been relatively successful for the past, you know, 4 or 5 months. That in itself suggests that all might not be well internally. They've brought in Alan Walters, a great coach, worked with Munster under Razzie. He worked with the Springboks as well. They've brought him into England for it didn't happen this season. He's brought him in a while. They've also brought in Felix Jones directly from the Springboks coaching staff. And he is implementing the high edge blitz that has been a big factor of Springbok rugby for the last while. And now they're bringing it in to England to kind of supercharge the kicking game that they've already brought. I suppose the problem is that having a kicking style that was already fairly heavy when it came to volume and meters kicked, and then bringing in such a proactive defense as, you know, the high edge overlapping blitz that, you know, it's not the exact same because Felix Jones is putting his own slant on what worked and what, you know, Jacques Nienaber pioneered at the Stormers first, then at Munster, and then at the Springboks. So if you're going to be using that defensive style, it does mean more kicking. Because again, there's no point in training a defensive system like that and have it eat up most of your sessions, as the report said, if you're not going to use it in game and you don't use your defense as a weapon with the ball in your hands. It works with the ball in their hands. So that means that you're going to be kicking the ball away. And again, a lot of players, that's an unpopular way of playing. And it's just one of those situations where if you're endlessly working set piece and you're working defensive structure, especially for outside backs, if the main thing you're working on is, oh, we're going to be, you know, working on defensive shape again here, what you're like on certain edge blitzes, what your positioning is, what your spacing is like with the guys who are around you, your role as a defensive leader in that system, that is, again, look, it depends on your mindset as a player, but it also can be quite taxing from a kind of a mental standpoint, in that there's lots to onboard. They're obviously putting in a ton of detail in on top of these guys because you're in the middle of the Six Nations. They haven't had a whole ton of time to work with Felix Jones and to work with their system beforehand. That's just one of the advantages of the Irish system that they don't have in England. And I think it comes across in it that guys are unhappy with that. And the reality is that there's no easy answer as to how you fix that. With South Africa, it's a different rugby country. It's a different culture there. For South Africans, the most important thing is winning. They had been and turned into something of a joke for a period of 2 or 3 years there under Alistair Coetzee, who's a good coach. Like he actually is a really good coach. But what he was trying to implement at the Springboks is almost the exact opposite of what England are doing now, in that he was trying to bring in a really expansive attacking style that was, it reflected his values. And it actually reflected probably why he was hired by the Springboks in the first place, in that he was quite successful as a coach running this style. The pitch he would have put into them at the time after Heineken Meyer left was that he was going to upscale the Springbok attack. But attack, when it's run like that, it's probably great to train, but the Springboks weren't enjoying it because they were losing. And like, that's why, like, the reports in the media, such as they were, and some of the stuff I've seen in the aftermath from the likes of Will Carling and Stuart Barnes and guys like that. Well, I've got a bit on him coming in a minute, actually. It surprised me because England are winning and doing relatively well playing this way. But it's not enough. It's like they want England to be winning loads of games, but also playing really attractive, ambitious rugby, which is not always possible. And I think Ireland are a big negative comparison at the moment, where Ireland are winning games and you know, widely recognised as being one of the best teams in the world. England want to get to that level, but they're doing so in a way which people can look at it and go, this is not going to be a good watch. This is going to be a lot of kicking, a lot of chasing, a lot of harrying, a lot of scrums, a lot of defense, and looking to try to, I suppose, looking to try to pressure the opposition to giving up, you know, transitions or set piece opportunities. And some people see that and go, that's not the type of rugby that I'm hugely interested in running. And look, I get that, but I think at the same time, you have to give this coaching group a chance to bed in what they're doing, because a lot of the building blocks are already there. Like, England already have a really good set piece. They have a good line-out, a good defensive line-out. They have a good offensive and defensive scrum. So those parts are already there. What they don't have is the time with the group of players who they will be selecting for the Six Nations or for upcoming tours or, you know, whatever, in November or next Six Nations. They don't have time with the group to bed in a complex attacking system. Like, some of the things I've seen have been, oh, well, look, should be, you know, look at Northampton, for example, playing a really attractive, you know, brand of rugby with and they're top of the table in the Gallagher Premiership. Can England not just do that? Well, I mean, they could, but they don't have the time with the group of players they have to properly embed that in, because, again, look, what a club does and what a test team can do, it's all based on time. You only have so many sessions. So unless you're going to select, you know, Northampton en masse pretty much and then just dot in a few, you know, other guys here and there, which, again, I don't think Northampton have that level of English qualified player at the moment anyway, you'd be missing out on certain other quality players that you want to build around as well. What Steve Borthwick has decided is, because we have already a good defence and we want to upscale that again, because we already have a good set piece, because we have a good scrum lineup, whatever, and because we're already quite a good kicking team, if we had a really offensive defence which forced mistakes out of the opposition, we'll win more games. And if we win more games, vibes will be better. Maybe we won't be a Grand Slam winning threat this season, but maybe by Six Nations 2025, maybe England are that team. And I suppose that's what his intent is. And his route to getting there is embedding in this Blitz defence. But I think if you're the English players, maybe there's a little bit too much of that. And maybe there's too much. Maybe training is getting a little bit boring. Maybe camp is getting a little bit boring, a little bit too much. Maybe the pressure is there. You know, where they recently lost to Scotland and started so well. And then to see Scotland winning it with, not style, because I think that Scotland have played well and they scored some nice tries. But the feeling is that England just never fired a shot in that game, which isn't true. But because their style of play is so kick orientated, it feels that they came away from it with, geez, we hardly landed a shot in these guys, which is, like I said, it's not true, but that's how it can feel. And I think that's what people are feeling at the moment, which is a lot of feelings. Like, so much of rugby punditry and the opinions that spring up around the game are down to feelings, emotions. And I sometimes kind of get into this idea that, well, okay, well, you're winning, so what? But for a lot of people, and this can be influential people in the media, it can be, you know, people online or whatever else, doing it without style, it kind of doesn't feel right. And it can be not distressing, but if it's unpleasant to look at and there's this feeling that you're playing anti-rugby, which people threw at the Springboks so often. So when they start doing it, it's almost like, I've got a lot of tweets to delete kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of what it feels like at times. But yeah, look, I think the whole part of that is, it doesn't reflect well on the group that somebody feels so, like, that somebody's either deliberately gone to a journalist and said it and complained, or they've been speaking to a journalist offhand and maybe said it in a way that it wasn't necessarily meant in the way that it came across, but they didn't have the discipline and the cop on to know that they could well report this, and all of a sudden then it's a big deal, which, if Steve Borthwick isn't asked about it this week ahead of the Ireland game, I'd be surprised. But yeah, that's the kind of thing which it can destabilize the group a little bit, because some guys might be bored out of their skull playing that game and doing so much defense in those sessions. But again, if you want to embed that defense, you have to use up a lot of your time. Like, this is true for clubs, but it's even more true for test sides, because the time they have is so limited. They have to budget their minutes, and they've looked at their defense as being something that, well, we'll work on our set piece. What are we going to use our other minutes for? They've decided it's going to be defense, and that's what they feel will help them win more games and be more competitive at this level. So that's kind of it, really, from a, like, you know, from the Steve Borthwick's perspective. He's not going to change. He's not going to be overly swayed by this and all of a sudden go, yeah, you know, look, we are playing pretty much off-ball rugby. Let's become a high-on-ball team. Let's just do that. Let's just give it a lash. Because some of the stuff I've seen from, you know, the likes of Will Carling and guys like that have been... It's like they kind of just want to throw out the last 25 years of modern rugby and just go back to, well, if you just try hard enough and want it enough, then you know what? You'll win. And again, it's feelings, it's emotions, it's nostalgia. And I don't think it has a place really in the modern game. It's just a recipe for losing, but kind of feeling better about yourself. So you can kind of, you know, give the whole, you know, we lost, but we won thing. But yeah, no, it's just a thing where I think people have a little bit of growing up to do when it comes to appreciating how you go about winning and appreciating what Steve Borthwick is trying to do. Look, and he will succeed or fail on results ultimately, as every coach does. But I think this year is a little bit too soon to judge him. If it's a case that by the next Six Nations, and if they've had a bad November, like touring wise, I think they're playing the All Blacks and I think they're playing the Springboks as well. If they've had a bad November coming into a Six Nations and they're still not clicking, he'll be under massive pressure. And look, there is no other way around that. But yeah, it certainly doesn't. It suggests that he's got a bit of work to do with his group yet to get the philosophy of what he's trying to do over with them. And I'm sure he's doing that right now, actually. The other questions that I've had based on the last, you know, week or two of England rugby has been Stuart Barnes talking about the team that he would pick for the Ireland game coming up at the weekend, which had Ben Earl in midfield. I had a lot of people asking me about, you know, given how much time I spend talking about roles and role sets, that would that actually work? And I don't think it would be a disaster, offensively anyway. From what I understand of what Stuart Barnes' point was, is that Ben Earl is a really good ball carrier. So what if he was at number 12, where, as far as Stuart Barnes is concerned, he would see the ball a lot more often? And look, that's certainly plausible. But I think if you're Stuart Barnes, you kind of have to look at, well, what does Ben Earl do really well? He's really good at carrying in the wider areas. He's really good at the offensive and defensive breakdown out there in those areas as well. He's actually closer to a winger than what he is at 12. I think what Stuart Barnes is thinking is, off scrum and line out, let's run him at 12. But like, if you look at a line out, like, he will often be in midfield on a line out. Like, he's not a heavy strike wing forward or a heavy wing forward, in that he's a good ball carrier anyway. He's dynamic, he's explosive. I've got to do my work on England yet. So far, I haven't done it for the Green Eye yet, to see, like, this week. But when I do, I wouldn't be surprised to see Ben Earl running in midfield for England on their five-man lineouts, for example, because he doesn't strike me as somebody who would be a regular jumper. But again, you would look at and say, well, look, oh, right, so what about at the scrum? England might have four or five scrums in a game, and putting him at 12 for those, I mean, what's the point? Like, you can already put him in midfield off a lineout. You don't need to have him there. He doesn't need to just be, because he's a forward, be in the lineout. Like, you often see on five-man lineouts having two forwards in midfield. Ben Earl can absolutely be one of those. The reason why I wouldn't put him in midfield is because he'd get absolutely sliced to pieces in defence. Like, I think people are looking at it and going, well, look, he's really good defending in tight channels, and he is. But he wouldn't be defending in tight channels if he's playing at 12. He'd be defending in the wider channels, which, look, he's got good pace. He could cover the ground, I'm sure, to a certain extent. But if he's playing Ireland at the weekend, do you think he really wants to be defending, we'll say, 25 metres of space with Jack Crowley running at him full pelt, maybe Calvin Nash running on in the second layer, with Robbie Henshaw running a pinch line, or Bundy Aki running a pinch line, and James Lowe on the outside, or Hugo Keenan running an arc line on the outside. Do you think Ben Earl wants to be defending that? Like, no, he is much happier, I would say, defending closer to the ruck where things are. There are simpler equations, which is, I'm going to either tackle that guy or that guy, rather than being further out on, we'll say, on first phase of a lineout, for example, where you get pulled out of position by Jack Crowley and you're going, well, I'm either tackling Jack Crowley or Calvin Nash inside, or Hugo Keenan maybe on the outside, or Bundy Aki coming on the crash line, who's almost as big as I am. I don't necessarily want to be defending, like, as in, there's so many options there. So, like, yeah, look, maybe it would work in attack, but I wouldn't feel it's even necessary. Like, I think it comes from a kind of an outdated, just looking at the team sheet on a graphic thinking, where, well, 12s usually crash the ball up a lot. What if Ben Earl was there? You don't have to be that guy anymore. Like, that's not... Like, roles are so different, and people were asking me the question, like, as in, well, would it make sense from a role perspective? But no, but you could play him at number 11 if you wanted. Like, or you could just play him where he currently is, because from a faceplate perspective, he gets the ball about as often as is realistically plausible. Just because he has number 12 in his back doesn't mean he's going to be making 20 carries a game. It doesn't mean he'd be effective for all 20 of those carries either, by the way. And it also limit the scope of your own attack as well. Because look, Ben Earl is as good as a player as he is, not a distributor. And like, you look at the modern midfielder, like, very rarely now are guys, they're just going to hit the ball up. Very rarely is that the case. So I get the thought process that Stuart Barnes is bringing in. I understand what he's trying to do. But for me, I think role sets aren't basically, oh, well, look, this guy is a strike wing forward. Could he be an outside centre? In theory, yes. In phase play, he plays out there anyway. But if you're talking about just doing it just so you can stand in a certain place on set piece, that to me doesn't make sense. Because again, even defensively, like, he will defend in those. Like, because if say, for example, Ireland had a line out and Ben Earl was playing 12 for them, what would Ireland do? Ireland would go, we're having a full lineout. We're having a full seven-man lineout. So that would mean that there are no other forwards in midfield. It is their 10, George Ford. It is their 12, Ben Earl. And it is their outside centre, whoever it would be. It would be Manu Tuilagi, you would say, whatever. So Ireland would do that on every lineout. Why? To increase the spacing between George Ford and Manu Tuilagi, and as a result, increase the positional pressure on Ben Earl, who isn't used to defending all that space off set piece. And Ireland would just go at him all day long. And not just go at him, they would go at George Ford to pull out Ben Earl, because Ireland can adjust laterally quickly, more quickly than Ben Earl can. There's a reason why these positions and like certain things on set piece, they require a certain level of skill set. On face play, look, if there was no line out, or scrum or whatever else, yeah, look, play him wherever. Put whatever number you want in his back. But yeah, because of the defensive side of it, it just wouldn't work for me, because all Ireland would do was literally just spam seven-man lineouts all day long. And as a result, there'd be very little for Ben Earl to work with. Some of the other questions I've had in the last while, and I'm spitting this podcast into two, by the way, because I was going to do a 90-minute podcast, as I said yesterday, but people don't really listen to 90-minute podcasts. They don't. Like, 45 minutes is the sweet spot. So I'm just going to split them in two and put them on Tuesday and Wednesday. This one is from Mike. Hi, Mike. If all the players for all the provinces were released tomorrow and you were appointed the GM of one of the provinces, Munster in this instance, who are you taking first overall in the draft? Beyond that, are there specific players you would target and a specific side of play you would try and implement? I would get in Jack Crowley, number one pick straight away. Reason being is, a lot of the other stuff you could bring in, like if you're looking at different forwards, there's a good number of, you know, physical forwards you could bring in. I know that in this case, there's a draft. Other people are going to pick, you know, guys that they want first. But I think that the most consistent way to get success at any team in this game is to have an elite level 10. I think Jack Crowley is on the verge of being that. Not that he's not elite now. He's obviously a very good young player. He's taken the test level ridiculously well. But I think he's still maybe 6 months away from being in that elite level discussion. I think if he goes well on the tour to South Africa, if he goes well with Munster this season even, and gets into that November series still as the number one guy, again, fitness plays a big part in this. I think by the next Six Nations, he could well, even with a Grand Slam under his belt, that would be when I'd go, yeah, this guy's an elite level talent. He's like, he looks like a fella who's going to be an elite level talent right now. But again, I think it's too early to throw stuff like that around on players. Once he's a seasoned starter for Ireland, we'll have a really good idea as to what he is and what his level is. At the moment, it looks like he's going to be an elite level guy, but we have to see how it plays out. I have every confidence he is going to be that guy, but I just like to see it, if that makes sense. This next one is from Jack. Tom, you watch the AIL every week. How does the tackle height law and the number of substitutions affect the game? Do you think at full pro level you could see any rule changes like that? Tackle height, less subs or anything at all? Even those kind of mad suggestions Gatland made in the paper a good while ago come in. At the start of the season it was difficult. You could see that teams weren't really adjusting to it. There was a lot of penalties. And like there is a few more penalties in AIL anyway. Because if you watch AIL for any extended period of time, you're going to see a lot of maul tries. And you're going to see a lot of line-out mauls and scrummaging. That's just, that comes with the AIL. Like, if you wanted to win the AIL tomorrow, the first thing I would say to you is get a good kicking game and get a good line-out drive. Line-out maul. And you will win a lot of games in AIL. But, like, the tackle height, teams have mostly adjusted to it now. You'd still see the odd one, like Paddy McCarthy got caught for a high shot there against Cork Conn a few weeks ago. He is kind of coming from the pro environment, though, where that tackle would be legal. But even with the less subs, I think at pro level, to kind of answer the main bones of your question, to answer it about the AIL, it hasn't really affected it that much from what I can see. Guys struggled to adapt earlier in the season, but they mostly have. And there's the odd controversial one, all right, you know, where a guy might get yellow carded or there might be a key penalty given away for a tackle that if you did it at pro level, they'd be saying, you know, good shot. But I think that's part of the adjustment that's going to happen when this is brought into the full pro game, which I feel is an inevitability. Like that will come in. It won't be this season or next season, but I think inside, before the next World Cup, I would say, or maybe just after the next World Cup, they will make that adjustment where you can't tackle above the waist, we'd say above the stomach, which you can actually hear me rubbing on this microphone. See? Do you hear that? This is how good that microphone is. But yeah, that's the kind, like, that it will come in. I welcome it. It will make the game safer. It'll make it, we will hopefully see fewer concussions. Now, that's not a guarantee, but just on the papers that I've seen, the stats that I've seen, whenever you lower the tackle height, the number of concussions drops with it. And that's what we want to make this game sustainable going forward. If those changes are not made, it would put the finances of the game under massive pressure. It will make it less attractive to parents, who we want them to feel comfortable having their kids play from 5 years of age on up to 18, 19, 20, into their 20s, play with their AIL club or to play with the local, you know, junior club or whatever else, or to go play pro rugby. To have that be a comfortable decision for them to make when the kids are young, to go, do we really want them to end up playing this game? The fewer concussions we have, the safer the game looks, the more likely that is. And it doesn't mean you can't market the game as being a big physical contest between fucking guys who put massive stakes on the line, and every game is important and every moment is intense and it can be a big physical game. But we just want it to be where guys can come out of the game and not be having, you know, like the kind of migraines or the CTE or the guys with dementia in their 40s. Like, that's not, we, like, as in, the game can't survive that. Like, that's come from the 90s and maybe the 2000s. In 10 years, if guys are coming out of the game and they're still like that, we won't have a game. So I want to keep this game going. I want to keep covering this sport going forward. So, like, for the health of the game and the health of the money and people who rely on the game, to me, the tackle height will come down. As for substitutions being limited, I don't see that happening. I think that's actually, it does the opposite when it comes to player safety. I think that you should be able to replace, as in, maybe even make it where you can replace more guys. Because I think one of the biggest differential and causes for injury is a tired guy tackling a fresh guy. But if it's a case that pretty much everybody was fresh, you would see, you know, the game being, if the game was made safer with the tackle height, we'll say, there's no reason why you couldn't have a really, really intense game being played out almost at full pelt for 80 minutes. I think there's this idea that for attacking rugby to occur, you know, props must be tired or big second rows must be tired. I think if there was limited substitutions, we would find people, you know, trying to burn the candle at both ends, where we still want you to have a lot of size on, but we also need you to do 80 minutes. So I think what you'd see is guys maybe, again, look, there'd have to be a concession for people who got concussions, right? But again, then you're kind of looking at, well, could that be gamed? How could that be gamed? I think that ultimately, if we want a safer game when it comes to impacts, I think you need to make sure that we're actually playing for 80 minutes, right? I think I've said it before on a different podcast. My ultimate idea for making the game safer and for, we'll say, depowering certain aspects of the game is let's play rugby for 80 minutes, not 40 minutes, not 35 minutes. Because, like, people were talking about there about how, you know, Ireland versus Wales was 43 minutes of ball and play time. I know that the World Rugby are talking about ball and flow time, which, because ball and play, like, that can just be two teams kicking the ball to each other, like, you know, like that is technically ball and play. But ball and flow is where one team is attacking and then there's a turnover and then the other team attack. And it's a bit like soccer or basketball, where the ball is constantly moving, but it's moving through the hands of the players. I think one of the biggest issues in rugby at the moment is there's too much standing around where the clock is moving, right? So when you have a penalty, for example, ball goes out of touch and you're waiting for the opposition team to take a line out. Why is the clock ticking when they're walking up to the line out? If you're setting up for a scrum, why is the clock ticking when you're doing nothing? You're getting ready for a scrum. You're getting set. Why is the clock ticking? How many times have you seen a game where one team is chasing the lead, right? Maybe they're 2 points back and the opposition get a scrum in the other team's half of the field. How many times have you seen 2 minutes getting burned off the clock on just getting set up for a scrum and, oh, look, a collapse. Would you believe it? And then you have another setup and then it's 2 or 3 minutes and all everybody is doing is just watching these guys getting set up for a scrum. That, to me, is a waste of time. What we should be looking at is that the clock is only moving when the ball is moving. So the clock doesn't start until that ball comes out of the scrum. So that would give you opportunities. If you were a team, for example, who had a really good scrum, you were down on the clock. It's coming down to the last 30 seconds of the game, for example. You have a scrum, but the clock isn't moving. If you get your scrum going on, you win a penalty. The clock hasn't moved. There's still 30 seconds left. When that ball is kicked down the line, for example, maybe you're 5 points or you're 5 points back, you need a try. So you kick the ball down the line. The ball's not moving, or the clock isn't moving, because the clock only moves when the ball is in play. So when that ball gets out into the touch, it's not moving when you walk down to the line out. So that's like, those are dead minutes. The clock is not moving. When that ball comes in, now we're playing. When that ball is taken, or when that ball leaves the hooker's hands, clock is on. And then you're playing 80 minutes of actual moving around the field and playing. That's why I think that, you know, you would end up having to have guys who were fitter and maybe a little bit lighter, Because if you're only playing 40 minutes of ball and play in a game, like that's 80 minutes long, what's happening the rest of the time? And I think that if you make those 80 minutes where maybe it's not always guys just kicking the ball back and forth to each other, but the clock only moves when the ball moves, then you have to play those 80 minutes. There's not going to be, oh, we're not going to have a 30-second breather here or a 3-minute breather here while guys get set up for a scrum. Every minute must be played. I think that would help to depower the game. If you combine that with a lower tackle height, I think it would make it safer. I think it would make for more interesting games. I think it would make for good end games as well, which kind of up the drama and the stakes of it, especially if the clock is stopped. Can they win a penalty? If they win a penalty, okay, now they get a chance to kick down the line. And once that clock starts going, if there's 20 seconds left, all of a sudden that makes that maul defense there really, really intense. And you're getting value for money. Sometimes I feel like, you know, fellas want to show up to the rugby, have it done in an hour, and then fuck off to the bar. If I'm going to a game like that, if it takes 2 hours, fine. But I want to see 2 hours of rugby. I don't want to see like 2 hours where 40 minutes of it, there's rugby happening. And then for the other 40 minutes, fellas are kind of standing around and like chatting to the ref, or, you know, they're drinking out of a water bottle or walking up to a lineout or stuff like that. I think that being judicious about stopping the clock and making sure that it only moves when the ball is moving, that would give you a more exciting product. It would mean that players have to be conditioned to play 80 minutes of rugby rather than 40 minutes of rugby, we'll say at most, with, you know, 40 minutes of standing around. And I think then you end up with a more of a flowy game, in my opinion. Some of the other questions coming in here. Let me just load them up here on my screen. In the latest Workrate article, you speak about how moving the ball carrying load into the second row has Ireland's success under Farrell. Can you talk a bit about the advantages of that approach? Well, what they have discovered is that it is easier for taller, longer athletes to get over the gain line if you're hitting them in midfield. That has been a real recipe for success for Ireland. For James Ryan, laterally, or in the first place, he was a guy who changed up how Ireland played. He was a massive ball carrier for Ireland, not just off 9 either. He was mostly used off 10. And he helped Ireland advance up the field quite a bit in his first breakthrough season and for a few seasons afterwards. His role has kind of changed since, and there's a question about James Ryan coming up there as well in a minute, where he's not really the same player he was, and it seems like he's trying to get back to that. But Ireland have, under Farrell, with the style of play that they use, short passes, they have the most amount of passes off 10 in the intervening 4 years in the Six Nations. That means that they're hitting something off 10. That's mostly the locks. And the back rows then are used in a more of a supporting capacity where guys like Hale and Doris will carry the ball as well. But Ireland pass the ball so much when Ireland are in possession that it makes sense that one of your primary goal forward guys are your taller, heavier athletes. Ireland kind of went away from the back row being a primary ball carrying outlet when CJ Stander retired. And what they've done off that is it's kind of tailored really well with what they're bringing at, you know, from a game style perspective under Sexton and the personnel they had available to them. I don't think it's a surprise to see Ian Henderson and James Ryan as the pairing for the Grand Slam in 2018, for example, when Ireland started to move towards this. But looking at Tadhg Byrne, how important he's become in that system, I think in part because there was so much involvement for the second rows as a ball carrier. I think he's even mentioned this in interviews as well, where he doesn't mind playing at six, but he likes playing in the second row because it's you're busier. There's more to do there. And like Ireland used their locks like that, not by a massive amount, by a percentage, you know, how much more they carry than the back row, but it's enough for it to be notable. And what it does is it put pressure on your ability to retain the ball. That's why I think Ireland's offensive ruckwork output, it ballooned for the back row in under Farrell. Whereas in, I think under Schmidt, I think the front five would have had way more involvements there. Under Farrell, that offensive ruckwork has gone to the midfield. It's gone to the back row. And you'll often see the second row pairing for Ireland hovering around 40 offensive ruckwork points. with the back row being the guys who could go 50 plus, 60 plus at times. Stylistically, it just gives you, it's just a different way of playing. It's a different way of skinning the cat, so to speak. And I think that it works with the, as you can see with James McCarthy, if you can get guys who have that, you know, 6 foot six, over 115 kg, and you've got, you know, a lock replacement you'll use in the bench for sure, you get more cover. You can have one guy use up all his minutes or use up all his energy in a certain number of minutes. And when you have a guy like Ty Byrne, it kind of helped, like he helped you do all of that. And I think his value as a swing lock really makes what Ireland do offensively. It makes it tick. Somebody asked me here, Scannell versus Sheehan, who is the better throw? Dan Sheehan does. Nobody has a better throw than Dan Sheehan, in my opinion. Niall Scannell is right up there, though. Really, really good line-out thrower. As we've seen since he's come back from his injury, actually, how much Munster's line-out has improved just because Niall Scannell is back. Like, Munster have made a few adjustments with regards to where we're throwing to as well, but the accuracy he's able to throw it is really, really good. I do actually think that Niall Scannell is better throwing to the tail than Sheehan is, but the accuracy Sheehan can throw at the front of the middle, for me, he's in a league of his own there, I think. This is from Barry C. I have a vague feeling, vibes only, based on snippets read here and on the Patreon, that Aki and Henshaw is a better necessary midfield combination because both offer more as auxiliary flankers in terms of offensive ruck work than Ringrose, making up for the fact that the Ireland pack's offensive ruck work output has dropped a bit. Any truth to this vibe? No, I would put Gary Ringrose as being a really important player for Ireland from an offensive ruck work perspective. He has been consistently up there, giving you around 35 points generally when Ireland are playing well. And he's really, really good at that aspect of the game. The reason why I think that Henshaw and Aki are actually a better pairing is offensively, not just at the breakdown. I think they have a better understanding. I think that Henshaw is a more powerful runner. I think that in combination with Henshaw or with Aki, that gives you more screening options that when Ringrose is there, isn't necessarily as strong. I think that Henshaw and Aki, they work really well together. They seem to have a really good relationship that goes back to when they were both at Connacht. Obviously, Ringrose and Henshaw are as well. But what I like about Henshaw and Aki is defensively at the breakdown, they're both really good. But I think it's the extra physicality of Henshaw that adds so much to what Ireland are doing from a screening perspective that maybe Ringrose doesn't have. But he offers you different stuff, does Ringrose. Like, he is a more aggressive and kind of quicker, more agile defender. And like I said, his offensive ruck work is really good as well. I think it's a good decision to have if you're Andy Farrell. You're making a choice between two really good players and whoever basically is playing the best at any given time. I would expect, though, it's going to be Bundy Aki plus whoever. So it's either going to be Ringrose or Henshaw. I could easily see Ringrose on the bench, you know, weirdly enough as well. Jack says, Tom, I know Ireland got knocked out of the World Cup. However, I think it's fair to say that rugby interest hit a new high during the tournament, even if it ended like a wet fart. Have you noticed from TRK this carrying over into the URC and Heineken Cup and into the Six Nations? Do you think there's a bigger audience out there for rugby to grab in Ireland? Yeah, like I have. Well, TRK is up year on year from a subscriber's perspective. And that's obviously a massive positive for me from a money perspective. Like I'm making good money now from TRK, which again, I know can disappear instantly. So like that's the thing with subscriber content like this. It's good for the moment, but there's nothing to say that it's going to keep doing that. Obviously winning and Ireland being, you know, being seen to being winners for the most part and playing a really, you know, attractive style of rugby while they're doing it, adds a lot. That adds a lot of attention. It adds a lot of interest. Like, for example, like trying to get tickets for Ireland rugby games in the Aviva is impossible. It is so hard to do. And that's because just of how popular it is. Like Ireland, the Ireland rugby team at the moment is big business. Like lots of sponsorship money. There's lots of, like, they sold out a dinner. What was it? €650 per plate. There's lots of attention on it. It certainly has rolled over into TRK this year. And like my coverage of Ireland, I think that like since the Six Nations started, a lot of subscribers there as well. I'm not sure why, because like as in I haven't been crawling with praise for Ireland. Like I think I've been pretty measured. I've had a few areas of critique, obviously, but like that's something I think maybe is a strength in some ways. Because some of the coverage I've seen of Ireland has been. It's been fairly embarrassing at times, actually. Some of the stuff I've seen written about, like fellas pissing in our pockets, like to me, like the Sam Warburton thing, for example. I've had a few questions about that too, so I'll roll it into this. About Ireland are the best team in the world. To me, like I Sam Warburton saying that, like I'd be taking almost that as a bit of an insult. Like, do you know, like he knows full well that we've been out in the quarter final of the World Cup. Talking about Ireland being the best team in the world now after three rounds. Of a Six Nations where we beat a France who should have been beaten by Italy. We've beaten a Wales team who are in a massive reset for probably the first time in 10 years. They're having so many guys, you know, moving out of the team and young fellas coming in. And then beating Italy, who we haven't lost to in 10 years. Like, to be saying we're the best in the world off the back of that, that to me is like a guy pissing in your pocket. Like, you'd be looking at that kind of going, you're taking the piss. Because I'm looking at Ireland, I'm thinking, yeah, obviously we're playing really well. It'll be a big test now against England coming up this weekend in Twickenham. But saying Ireland are the best in the world when there was the World Cup 5 months ago where we were out in the quarterfinals and South Africa won it, I don't know. I think like that to me came across as being a bit of an insult, really, like a fella taking the piss. Because like we're plainly not the best team in the world. South Africa won the World Cup. And this isn't, we're not talking about something that happened like 12 months ago. Like this was only 4 or 5 months ago this happened. If Ireland wanted to be the best team in the world, we would have won the World Cup when we were in it. This idea that we're the best team in the world right now because we're after beating those three teams in, you know, fair objectively, like it's a fairly weak Six Nations. To me, if I'm seeing that, if I'm like Sir Paul O'Connell or lads in the group, I'm looking at that. If that ever comes up in the group, I'm just like thinking that's a bit of an insult to us for them to be talking like that. Like we've done nothing. You know, if you want to go down to South Africa in the summer and say, if we beat those guys, if we win a test down there, yeah, maybe we're up there with the best team in the world. Beat them twice down there. Yeah, we are the best team in the world right now. But the idea that you can beat that while South Africa are, you know, they haven't even played a game and they're building in new systems or whatever else, while we're probably the least disrupted of France, of England, of Wales. That to me, it was just like, felt that was a bit of an insult, really. Like, Sam Warburton almost knows what he's doing there, if that makes sense. Do you know? Like, fella pissing in your pocket like that. That to me, it was just like, nah, not for me. This next one is from Evan. Tom, was thinking of potential next captains for Munster and kept landing on Alex Kendallin and Craig Casey. And I have a question about each of them. On Kendallin, early in the season, he struggled in the wing forward role and has, to the best of my knowledge, played more in one of the central pods since. Do you think his best role will be as an edge forward or central? Or will he have the ability to play both depending on the matchup without becoming too versatile for his own good and never settling in a position and making it his own? And on Casey, a lot of teams use a two-man defensive backfield of a fullback and a scrum half. Conor Murray has played that role brilliantly for Ireland in recent years. I think a backfield of Casey and Ben O'Connor could be phenomenal for their combined agility to cover ground and their right foot, left foot, kicking access. But would that make Casey less suitable for captaincy if he was often in the backfield defensively, not being able to talk to the referee? Good questions, Evan. On the first one with Kendallin, I think he certainly got the potential. And like you look at the last couple of weeks, captaincy has really suited him. He's kind of, his game has come on a good bit in the last while just based on how well he's kind of grown into being a captain. It's almost like he kind of doesn't, his performance levels go up a little bit because he's the captain. Some guys, it's the opposite. For him, anyway, it definitely goes up. But I'm looking at the back row and how competitive it is. And he could absolutely work as captain. But I think it's so congested there that you could be limiting yourself, if that makes sense. Whereas I look at Craig Casey and I think Munster will go to a backfield of Crowley and whoever. It'll be Crowley plus whoever in the backfield. With Casey defending the edges. He's really good in that scrappy defender in that area. I think that will be the future. But I think Craig Casey, to me, has Munster captain written all over him. Just the way that he is around the organisation, like, you talk to different guys and they all rave about this guy as a leader and as a character. We're blessed at the moment, actually, that there's so many guys who are coming through who have that attitude about them, like Jack Crowley does, Dermot Barron does, Casey does, obviously. And that all adds to it. That all adds to your resume when it comes to making that decision. The decision hasn't been made yet. I think I wouldn't be surprised at the moment if it's Tadhg Byrne, but I think in the long term, I would go with Craig Casey if it was me. I just feel that scrum halves as captains sometimes, I think, can be quite good. They're right next to the referee an awful lot, on maybe the defensive side of the ball, but offensively, certainly. Like, you want to not concede penalties in defence, really, more than you want to win breakdown penalties. If you win a breakdown penalty, it'll be obvious. Going forward, though, it's good to have the captain right there, because how often have you seen a penalty award and the scrum half is right there? That, to me, I think is a good possible outcome for him stylistically for the captain. I know sometimes, weirdly enough, people have this idea that the captain has to be, you know, massively tall so the referee's looking up at him. I don't think that'll be an issue here. Like I said, I would go with Craig Casey. I just feel that he's got that aura of a captain about him. So, yeah, we will see how that goes. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was him. And finally, on this part one of this mailbag, is a question about James Ryan, where basically the question was, I haven't got it in front of me here, but the question was, am I being a little bit unfair on him based on my ratings of him in the Offensive Ruckwork articles and my rating of him from a star rating perspective in the Wally ratings over the last couple of years. My criticism of him has been quite intense at times. This is from a Leinster subscriber who likes the content. It's not griefing or trolling or anything. But I have criticised James Ryan quite a bit. And I think the reason why is, as I mentioned there earlier, stylistically, I think that since he broke through, he had a period there for around 2 years when he broke through where I was convinced that this guy was going to be Lions captain, iconic player for Ireland. Then he kind of hit a bumpy enough period where he started to get a few injuries, and it felt that during COVID, the first period off during COVID, he had a shoulder injury, came back from that, and he was just stacked. Like, he came back so big. I think that Ireland wanted him to have that size on him where he came through. Like, go back and look at pictures of James Ryan when he first broke through into the senior Ireland team, not the under-20s, the senior Ireland team. And he looks like a different guy. You look at him now and he is stacked. And that happens, obviously. Guys go through physical changes as they, you know, are doing pro S&C for 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. But like the size of his neck now, like the size of just his muscles, big physical guy. I think as he's put on that weight, and apparently he's listed now lighter than what he was when he broke through. He was listed at 110 when he broke through in 2018. He's listed at 107 right now, which to me, I don't see it. But it feels that he's lost some of his agility and he's a little bit stiff with his movements. And like the game he started against Italy, he had a brilliant first 20 minutes and then just dropped out of the game. It's almost like he kind of either blew himself up in that first 20 minutes of activity where he was hitting tons of rucks. He was everywhere, like, as in, he was carrying the ball. And it just feels that the reason why Joe McCarthy has taken his starting spot and why, you know, James Ryan hasn't taken automatically the spot next to him is because he isn't as accurate at the breakdown as what Tadhg Byrne is. He doesn't give you the agility that Tadhg Byrne does. And when I mention agility, when I'm talking about a second row, I'm talking about your ability to cover space defensively, but offensively, your ability to adjust, your ability to, you know, go from a position where you're looking for an offload, for example, or a pass, to then be able to get into a breakdown clearing out position. Tadhg Byrne is really, really good at that aspect of the game, where his body shape, his ability to move and shift positions where he's in a perfect position to carry the ball, but now he's in a perfect position to do a really effective clean out. His agility in being able to change positions and body heights and everything like that is fantastic, on top of being a really good and agile line-out jumper and counter jumper. Now, James Ryan is a really good counter jumper as well, but he doesn't really have to adjust his body to do that. He literally just goes up. In the last 3 years, it feels that his breakdown work has plummeted from an accuracy perspective. He is often there first, but he is most often, like, he's got a huge number of inefficient entries from the ratings that I've put in. And I'm rating these down the line. And, like, you look at different positions where Peter Manny's had a poor game. I've put down there that he's had a poor game. Guys I like, don't like. It's not like I don't like any player. But I've no dog in the fight one way or the other. Like, if James Ryan is doing well, then he's doing well for Ireland. Ireland are doing well, which means I'm doing well. So, like, I want James Ryan to play really well. And he's a lovely guy. But I feel that in the last 2 or 3 years, it's almost like he's lost the role that he had nailed down coming in. Like, when he came in, his natural game was exactly what Ireland needed. And now it feels that, you know, 6 years later, it feels that it's kind of almost passing him by a small bit, where you could look at him and go, I don't know what your role is. Like, defensively, I think he's Ireland's best lock when it comes to making big stop, you know, tackles that stop fellas and, you know, bothering fellas at defensive breakdowns accurately there. Not necessarily stealing the ball there. I think Tadhg Byrne would be the best in that area. But from a dominance perspective, I think defensively, James Ryan is very, very good in that aspect of the game. But if Ireland are kicking the ball less often, and, like, when we do kick it, it's kind of in a very offensive way. It's not necessarily setting up for, well, now we're going to catch you on counter transition. Ireland aren't doing that anymore. I think part of the reason why Joe McCarthy has come in and been so important for Ireland straight away has been because he gives you a power carrying option that James Ryan used to do before but doesn't now. And that can come down to injuries taking maybe 5% off your ball carry power, puts you back into the pack that way. Joe McCarthy at the moment is hugely effective. He's going to have to go through that injury period as well. It would be impossible to think of a second row who plays as abrasively as Joe McCarthy not having a load of medium-term injuries in the next 3 or 4 years. How you come out on the other side of that, that determines how you're going to be, if you're going to be a fella who's got a massive career going forward. Even then, look, James Ryan has had a really good career. He's having a really good career. He's co-captain at Leinster. He's still regularly playing for Ireland. I just think at the moment, from a style perspective, doesn't quite know who he is on field. Maybe that will change. Maybe Ireland's requirements will change. But at the moment, he's not the swing lock that Tadhg Byrne is. He's not as physically powerful on ball offensively as what Joe McCarthy is. I think he's lucky at the moment that Ian Henderson is injured, because I think Ian Henderson offers more of what Joe McCarthy does than what James Ryan currently does. But again, maybe a bit of time off over the summer. Maybe touring South Africa maybe that's not the best idea for him. Maybe it would be good for him to have a pre-season off where he goes, or a summer off before coming back in for pre-season. And if he's going to continue to lose weight, for example, maybe the agility comes back. Maybe he targets different KPIs. So as in, like, well, he used to judge himself on making, you know, 10 carries, you know, 10 plus carries, 10 plus tackles per game. Maybe I change my role. Maybe now I'm going to be not talking about offensive ball carrying. I'm more now about tackle. I'm more about ruck support. So I'm working on my agility and efficiency at the breakdown. You know, working on my maul platform, my scrummaging. That's going to be where I'm going to go. At the moment, it feels that, and this has been a problem since he broke through almost, he became Ireland's most important front five forward almost immediately. And then we said, well, as he's this guy anyway, he's on a central contract almost straight away. Well, why shouldn't he be 120 kg? Why isn't he going to be our tight head lock if we're paying him anyway? And I felt that he ballooned up in weight. There were some articles where he was even talking about how he jumped up like 8 kg in weight. That can be unpredictable on guys from an injury perspective, from a performance perspective. So I just feel that, looking at where he is as a player, I think that there's, obviously he's a good player. He's not turned into a rubbish player or anything like that. I just feel at the moment that his role is kind of in flux, and that what Ireland want from their second row at the moment is kind of moving out of the window where James Ryan was the most important guy. So, yeah, I think all of this stuff can be temporary. Maybe he needs to adjust his game a little bit. But, yeah, I think I don't think I've been necessarily unfair in him. Like I said, he's a lovely fella. But my issue would be just what I'm seeing on field doesn't match what I think at times people have down for him. And that leads to confusion when he hasn't played well and people are kind of still not talking about it and only really praise him for playing well and talk about how he hasn't been playing well once he has a really good game under his belt. But I think for proper consistency and you know, maybe being the guy who's going to partner John McCarthy going forward, it seems to be the plan at Ireland. It's going to be John McCarthy plus, you know, whoever. At Leinster anyway, I do think he needs to work on the accuracy at the breakdown. Even if it means he's coming in a little bit slower, maybe he's not there first, but the accuracy and making sure he's actually cleaning out the guy rather than just having, well, first, I think that would be the way forward for him. So thank you very much for joining me. Thank you very much for being a TRK subscriber. Look out for part two of this mailbag coming later on this week. If you have any questions for that, because I've got to go and record it right now in the next day or so, I'll be putting it together in different sessions. Send me in a question at info@3rakings.com. It'll be in part two for sure. And I will talk to you again later in the week.